13 months at the Dry Tortugas. For 13 months, I have been a soldier of the garrison of Fort Jefferson. It is the fortress that stands on Garden Key and frowns over the waste of waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Within these small 9 acres are congregated about 500 souls, fairly anchored out at sea and almost out of the world, we feel sometimes. Of our life here and of the little world of our own that we inhabit, let me send tidings to the great world beyond. The Dry Tortugas comprehend a group of 4 small islands lying about 60 miles from Key West in a southwesterly direction, about 90 west of Cuba, and nearly the same distance from the mainland of Florida. East Key, which lies about 6 miles from Fort Jefferson, contains some 15 acres and rises about 5 feet above the level of the sea. It is a complete waste, barren and uninhabited, its surface covered with thick brushwood and a species of cactus which we here call prickly pear, impassable and almost impenetrable. It is, however, a favorite resort of turtles and seabirds. In the turtle season, parties of men, generally accompanied by one or more officers who may like to sport, start for this island in the evening from the fort, lie out all night, and generally succeed in catching a turtle or two. The moonlight being exceedingly brilliant, the men lie concealed in the shrubs. When the monstrous turtle crawls up from the water like a silly, lovelorn maiden to complain to the moon, a rush is suddenly made upon him by the boys. Some head him off from the water, while the rest lay violent hands upon him. He is quickly turned upon his back, and his feet or flippers are adroitly secured by a strong line. If not, the next morning consigned to the tender mercies of the post-butcher, a string is placed around his neck, to which is attached a small board, marked with the letter of the company to which he belongs. He is then thrown into the breakwater, or moat, that surrounds the fort, to float around in lazy indolence, until the company cook intimates that his presence is needed in the kitchen. At times, more than a dozen of these animals may be seen floating about in the still water of the moat, lifting for a moment their strange half-human faces above the surface to take in a long breath and sink again. This island is also the resort of myriads of seagulls and pelicans. At night they lie so thickly all around that the men, if so inclined, can easily knock them down with a stick or seize them with their hand. Basketful of their eggs are brought off daily in the season, and when properly cooked they make a first-rate addition to the company mess. The foundations of Fort Jefferson, built entirely of coral rock, were laid on the island of Garden Key in the year 1846. The cost of the fort, from its foundation to the present time, and the engineers are still actively at work upon it, must have been immense. Every brick, every plank, and every trowel of mortar had to be transported from the north at incalculable expense. What idea possessed those men in power to undertake so great work at such cost is not easy to imagine. It is alleged that the place was intended as a rendezvous for our ships in the Mexican waters, but for this purpose we already possessed Key West, where a similar Fort Taylor stands, and where there is ample accommodation for supplies of coal and naval stores of all kinds. Again, it is asserted that it commands the Gulf. How, I fail to understand. No ship of war of a hostile nation need come within range of our guns. The navigation round here, owing to the hidden reefs, is extremely intricate and dangerous. Nor could we, with our 300 guns, hurt the enemy keeping well outside the reefs. The only use, it seems to me, that is or can be made of the fort, is that which it serves at present as a prison. But whether it was, in the first place, worthwhile to erect such a structure for such a purpose in such a climate, entailing also the necessity of a battalion of soldiers equally prisoners with those they guard, I leave to wiser heads to determine. Professor Agassiz, in his interesting work on the study of natural history, devotes a pleasant chapter to the age and formation of coral reefs, and explains the means by which may be approximately determined the age of these islands and surrounding reefs. He says that an intelligent head workman employed here watched the growth of certain coral that established themselves in the foundation and recorded their rate of increase. Other facts, from a variety of sources, confirmed the testimony thus received. This workman had shown the professor rocks on which coral had been growing for some dozen years, during which they had increased about half an inch in 10 years. A brick placed underwater in 1850 by Captain Wood of Tortugas, with a view to determine the rate of coral growth and taken up 8 years later, had a crust of Meandrina upon it a little more than half an inch in thickness. Similar testimony as to the growth of coral was furnished from Fort Taylor, Key West. Fragments of Meandrina that had been growing from 12 to 15 years averaged about an inch in thickness. Some specimens, however, not more than half an inch. From these and other data, the professor estimates the growth of coral at one-half a foot in a century. Proceeding upon very moderate calculations, he assigns to the Florida coral reefs an age quite sufficient to harass the chronological faith of those who believe the world to be but 6,000 years old. Indeed, upon the lowest calculation, based upon facts thus ascertained as to their growth, we cannot suppose that less than 70,000 years have elapsed since the coral reefs already known in Florida began to grow. Very beautiful specimens of white branching coral are collected by the men, and when occasion offers, sent north to their friends. A few feet, very often scarcely a foot beneath the surface of the water, except in the channel, which is deep, may be seen as one glides over it in a boat, a very forest of coral trees with branches beautifully regular and wide-spreading. Nor is the sea here devoid of other interest. Fish of strange form and color not seen in northern waters abound. The storm rolls in shoals of porpoises, and sharks are constant visitors. Shells, also, of rare and exquisite beauty are gathered on the reefs, and a species of moss, which impressed on cards, makes a beautiful picture for grace of form and variety of color. In the calm evening, it is pleasant from the ramparts to watch the golden sun sink to rest, and just as it touches the edge of the horizon to hear the bugle sound retreat, and before the last note of music has died away in space, the placid rest broken for a moment by the thunder of the evening gun, the stars and stripes that have all day long flaunted their glory from the sally port are run down. The toil of the day with its petty cares is over, and someone, as he breaks ranks, indulges in by no means original exclamation, "Another day in for Uncle Sam." The beauty of the setting sun in this climate surpasses anything I have elsewhere seen. Whether it is in reality more beautiful than in other places, or whether being about the only beautiful thing we really have here, and on that account liable to be overappreciated, I am unable to determine. After sunset, sometimes owing, I suppose, to some peculiarity in the waning light or its reflection, or the position of the clouds, one might easily imagine himself so placid as the sea, gazing upon some island lake. The clouds, hanging low down and thickly clustered together, form as it were a boundary, like the base of a hill. In the distance is Loggerhead Island, with its tall and beautifully symmetrical lighthouse, the feeble light just struggling into existence, though momentarily increasing in brilliancy as the pall of darkness deepens. Nearer still is the rugged little island of Bird Key, where our dead rest, the white headboards yet distinct in the fading light. Alas, since last year's yellow fever, they are thickly crowded together and mark where the poor young soldiers lie far from their northern homes. Fort Jefferson is an irregular hexagon in form. It mounts three tiers of guns, 11-inch Columbiads, two in the casemates, the third on the parapet, about 40 feet above the level of the sea. They are capable, I have no doubt, of giving a warm reception to any power foolhardy enough to make a trial of strength with the young republic. A considerable portion of the island lies outside the fort, on which are erected the wooden buildings used by the engineers, workshops, stables, etc. There are also three docks or wharfs projecting into the channel to which are moored the boats arriving. Two schooners run almost every week between the fort and Key West. A steamer also arrives semi-monthly from New Orleans, bringing commissary and other stores. The arrival and departure of these boats with the mails are almost the only incidents that rouse the inhabitants of the isles from their usual condition of torpid monotony, reliving the dull routine of drills, roll calls, guard mounts, dress parades, and other military duties. On such occasions, there is an eager rush for and anxious waiting at the post office. There are some who joyously bear off the covered letters of papers, and others who, scarcely believing that for them there is absolutely nothing, turn away with faces wearing an air of blank disappointment. We have a good library, pretty well stocked with books, and receive also some New York papers besides other publications, so that in this respect we are very fortunate, isolated as we are from the outer world. The entrance to the fort is through a handsome, well-built, and massive sallyport, immediately inside which is the garrison guardhouse. The view on entering is, I imagine, to a stranger, rather pleasant. On the right of the entrance is the lighthouse and residence of the keeper. On either side are coconut trees, furnished with a dozen or two large green nuts that never seem to ripen. Trees, green all the year round, and Spanish grass, planted with great care and watchful tenderness, greet the eye refreshingly. Underneath the trees, long ranges of shot piled symmetrically, and great guns not mounted yet, remind the visitor, should he for a moment be inclined to forget, the fact that he stands within the enclosure of one of the greatest fortresses in the United States. A well-kept, hard-cemented walk leads in a straight line from the sallyport to the officers' quarters. In the center of the fort is a miniature garden, nicely railed in which tropical fruits and vegetables are supposed to grow. What its actual production for the last 2 years has been, I am unable to state. It is, however, well watered and kept in good order, and makes a nice show to strangers, which is something. Our best water is the rain, which we catch and confine in cisterns. We have also steam machinery in full running order, capable of condensing several thousand gallons per day. Part of the troops, owing to the other buildings being unfinished, are quartered in the upper casemates, which are perfectly airy, pleasant, and constantly whitewashed. The greatest want experienced on the island is that of vegetables. Occasionally we get watermelons, bananas, and pineapples from Cuba, which sell at very extravagant prices. A good head of plain vulgar cabbage, so little esteemed in the outside world, would sell readily for a dollar here. The wonder is that some live Yankee does not settle somewhere on the coast of Florida and supply this place and Key West with vegetables, fruit, eggs, and butter. One with a moderate capital and energy would shortly realize a fortune. An attempt was made last summer to establish a garden on Loggerhead, 2 miles distant from the fort. This island contains about 25 acres, the soil consisting altogether of coral sand covered with cactus. But the idea was abandoned, the labor, expense, and inconvenience attending it being too great a price to pay for any doubtful good to be derived. During the prevalence of the yellow fever at the fort last year, when the garrison suffered terribly, Dr. Samuel Mudd, sent hither for complicity in the assassination of President Lincoln, was at one time our only physician. It is simple justice and gratitude to acknowledge the skillful and self-sacrificing service he rendered. I may add that nothing can be more exemplary than the conduct of the 3 political prisoners now on the island, Michael O'Laughlin having died of yellow fever last year. They performed the work assigned them without complaint and with apparent cheerfulness. If the iron sometimes enter their souls or the bitterness of their situation be felt, it is never exhibited. This, at least, if not much more, must be injustice to them be told. We have, as before stated, a good library. We have also, for those who desire to attend, the occasional services of an Episcopalian chaplain. And we have that which decidedly draws greater crowds than both the chaplain and library together, a very good theater, gotten up entirely at very great cost and labor and well supported by the present battalion. There are performances nearly every week. The plays are sent on from New York, and the dramatic company is kept pretty well informed in theatrical matters. The great difficulty that the managers labor under is the want of female characters, personated by real women. Soldiers do not, as a rule, make good lady characters, and especially here, the face of every man being so well known, their employment in the female department destroys the illusion of reality so necessary to good playing. A shout of derisive laughter often greets the false woman in expansive crinoline. The awkwardness of the figure and long stride betray the deception. Besides, despite of care, very ridiculous accidents in the dress arrangement will sometimes occur. Pins will get out of place and skirts will fall, betraying the masculine trousers. For a brief period, we had indeed a real live woman character, the very pretty and very talented wife of a non-commissioned officer, since promoted to another department, consented to act with the boys. Her acting and deportment were both excellent, and the enthusiasm on such occasions among the audience was unbounded. On the evening previous to her departure, a benefit was given her, and a goodly pile of greenbacks raked in. Notwithstanding the strength and security of this place as a military and general prison, many attempts at escape have been made from time to time. In 9 cases out of 10, such attempts meet with detection, entailing, of course, increased restraint and severer punishment. Yet sometimes reckless daring and ingenuity will baffle the most watchful vigilance. At retreat or sundown, the general prisoners are confined to their quarters in one section of the casemates. The military prisoners, when there are any, are placed in the guardhouse. A sentinel is placed at retreat at the prisoner's bastion, who allows neither ingress nor egress to any without proper authority. Another sentry is, of course, day and night on duty at the sally port, who allows no one unauthorized to pass out after tattoo. A third is stationed over the small fishing and pleasure boats at No. 1 wharf. These boats, after retreat, are secured within a wooden enclosure. Another sentry is on duty at the next wharf, some 30 yards distant, where there are no boats. These sentries outside have orders to allow no boat to leave without the inspection of the corporal or sergeant of the guard, and with the permission of the commanding officer and officer of the day. From this it will appear plain that escape by means of the boats is, if the sentries do their duty, almost an impossibility. However, escapes are made. Some 3 years ago, a white prisoner named Adair, accompanied by a Negro, managed to get out of one of the potholes unobserved. On a plank, they crossed to Loggerhead. There, they secured one of the lighthouse boats and reached Cuba in safety. Adair, however, who, if all accounts are true, was a very hard case with unparalleled baseness and unblushing audacity, endeavored to effect the sale into slavery of his dusky companion. The African, naturally enough, failed to perceive the justice or morality of this Caucasian philanthropist, and in order to avoid a worse fate than the one he had ventured his life to escape from, stated the real circumstances of the case to the Spanish authorities. The result was that both gentlemen were quietly given over to the captain of one of the island boats, then at Havana, and were furnished with transportation to their late marine residence. About 18 months ago, this Adair, still aspiring after a free field of action that the island afforded, made a second venture for liberty. Though then wearing a ball and chain weighing some 24 to 30 pounds, he again placed faith in a plank and reached Loggerhead safely, though the channel is infested with man-eating sharks. In his expectation of securing a boat, he was, however, disappointed. For a few hours he succeeded in hiding himself in the thick brushwood of the island, but was speedily brought to bay by a corporal's guard and forced to make an unconditional surrender. During the prevalence of the yellow fever last year, a successful escape was easily effected by a corporal of the regular service, 3 guardhouse prisoners and 1 general prisoner. The latter had been sentenced to be hanged at Key West for murder. After having tried to break jail and being shot down by some colored troops, he had his sentence commuted to imprisonment for life at the Dry Tortugas. This corporal, who escaped or deserted, had been detailed to superintend the party almost constantly engaged in burying the dead in the adjacent little island. The sentry over the boats had orders to allow him and his party of men to leave at all times, day or night. The 3 military prisoners were on this burying party. In this case, so far as securing the boat was concerned, all was plain sailing enough. The corporal simply betrayed the trust reposed in him. The general prisoner must have, it is supposed, crawled through an embrasure, swam across the breakwater, and met the boat outside. The next, and it is now believed successful attempt to escape, was made a few months ago by a man of some notoriety, commonly styled Colonel St. Leger Greenfell. Colonel Greenfell is one of the many Englishmen of aristocratic tendencies whose sympathies went with the lost cause. He had seen a good deal of the world, and by his own account, which there is no reason to doubt, had experienced rough fighting and hard campaigning both in the Old World and also in the barbarous monarchies and semi-civilized republics of South America. A man of restless and impetuous temperament, and by natural disposition a revolutionist, he threw himself into the cause of the South. Colonel Greenfell served, I believe, on Morgan's staff, and attained the rank of Brigadier General. Owing, it is said, to some difficulty with Mr. Davis, he threw up his commission in the Confederacy, reached Havana, and proceeded north. In New York, he had an interview with Mr. Stanton, then Secretary of War, whom he deceived, as he often has declared, with a spice of great satisfaction, both as to the strength and disposition of the Confederate forces. For this, he alleges, Mr. Stanton did not forgive him, and we should be rather surprised if he did. Be this, however, as it may, the old colonel was finally pulled up for complicity in the Chicago conspiracy and the projected attack upon Camp Douglas. He was tried with others by a military commission and sentenced to imprisonment for life, with hard labor, at Tortugas. Failing in many attempts to influence the executive through external and foreign pressure, the colonel determined to achieve freedom for himself or perish in the attempt. He must have succeeded in bribing or seducing from his allegiance one of the soldiers of the garrison. It was on the occasion of the latter being posted over the boats that the escape was made. With him were associated the irrepressible Adair of the Cuban expedition and two general prisoners, one of the latter a man of notoriously desperate character. The soldier deserted his post with his arms and equipments and cast his lot with the daring Englishman. The night on which they trusted to the mercy of the waves in a frail open boat was wild and stormy, almost without precedent. To risk one's life on such a night seemed insanity, and we all conjectured that they must have been swept into eternity before they were 300 yards from the fort. It seems, however, from southern newspaper accounts, that Colonel Greenfell did actually reach Cuba, and at last accounts was about to sail for Europe. I have endeavored to give some idea of this out-of-the-world fortress and its surroundings. Strangers landing here for a few hours, no doubt, may indulge in rhapsodies about its beauty. Its few coconut trees, just like those in pictures that adorn little missionary tracts, its apocryphal banana trees, its luxuriant grass and evergreen foliage. But perhaps if they were doomed to a 3 years' residence on this barren, broiling coral island, their ideas would be considerably modified and a good deal of the rosy tinting bleached out of their pictures. The End, read by Leonidas for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.